We're going to talk about the spondyloarthropathy chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook, www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein Pinion Vayet. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
And that warning is particularly relevant today. Spondyloarthropathy is, well, it's a pretty complex group of inflammatory rheumatic diseases. It often requires a high degree of clinical suspicion just to get the diagnosis right.
Right. So our mission in this deep dive is to really pull out those high-yield clinical nuggets, the surprising facts, the essential pathology, so that you can walk away understanding this disease family much, much better.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's jump right in with the single defining characteristic of this entire group. We're talking about diseases that are fundamentally seronegative. If you're a clinician, what does that term immediately signal to you?
It's the first huge clue. It basically guides the entire workup. Seronegative just means that when we test a patient's blood, those classic inflammatory markers you see in, say, rheumatoid arthritis are absent.
You mean things like rheumatoid factor?
Exactly. Rheumatoid factor, anti-nuclear antibodies, they're not there. So you have a patient with very clear inflammatory joint issues, but their lab report comes back blank for the usual culprits. That forces you to pivot.
It narrows the field right away. And as you said, this isn't just one disease, it's a related group. The sources really emphasize three main forms you need to know.
That's right. The big three are ankylosing spondylitis, reactive arthritis, and psoriatic arthritis.
And there's a fourth category too, right? Related to bowel disease.
Yes. For completeness, it's worth noting that if a patient has spinal illness from inflammatory bowel disease, so that's Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, those are also placed right in this seronegative category. They all share that same inflammatory architecture.
Okay, let's follow that architecture, because this is where the pathology goes from just, you know, uncomfortable inflammation to permanent structural change. It starts with inflammation, some cartilage destruction causing pain. But what happens in the spine that makes this so, so devastating?
The process is... It's unique, and it's frighteningly progressive. In the spine, the inflammation doesn't just destroy cartilage, it actually targets the annulus. That's the tough outer ring of the intervertebral disc.
And instead of just destroying it.
Right, instead of just melting away tissue, this inflammation acts as a signal for the body to create new bone within the disc itself. It's like it's trying to heal, but is healing completely wrong.
And this unwanted pathological bone growth has a specific, highly important name.
It does. We call these growths syndesmophytes. Think of them as tiny, abnormal bony bridges being constructed where there should only be soft, flexible disc tissue.
And if the body keeps building these bridges, the inevitable result for the patient's mobility is fusion.
Total fusion. We call it ankylosis. The syndesmophytes bridge the gap between vertebrae, and critically, the longitudinal ligaments that run up and down the spine also start to ossify, to turn to bone. The whole process ultimately turns a flexible spine into one rigid, brittle rod.
Wow. And that rigidity, as I'm sure we'll discuss, is the source of so many later complications.
A huge source, yes.
Okay, let's start with the prototype of this disease family, ankylosing spondylitis, or AS. It's famous for spine involvement, but where does the inflammation usually start? What makes it so hard to spot early on?
It starts very subtly. It often targets the joints between the vertebrae and the pelvis, specifically the sacroiliac joint and the pubic symphysis.
Which is why you look at the pelvis on an early x-ray.
Exactly. But as it ascends up the spine, fusing the lumbar, thoracic, and eventually the cervical segments, it creates this visual abnormality that is, well, it's virtually pathognomonic.
The moment everyone learns in medical school, the bamboo spine.
That's the one. On an x-ray, because those syndesmophytes are bridging all the gaps, they look just like the small ringed culms of bamboo. If you see that advanced ascending fusion, that bamboo spine, you are looking at ankylosing spondylitis.
Okay, moving on to the second type, reactive arthritis. The name suggests a reaction, but the key point is that it's not the joint itself that's infected, right?
That is the core difference. Reactive arthritis is triggered by a preceding infection, usually a GI or a genitourinary infection that happened maybe 1 to 3 weeks prior. The body fights off the virus or the bacterium, but then through some kind of immune cross-reaction, it starts attacking the joints.
And there are specific culprits to look out for.
Yes. Chlamydia is a common one, but also foodborne pathogens, you know, like Yersinia, Salmonella, Shigella, and Campylobacter.
So if you're taking a patient's history and they mentioned a bout of diarrhea a few weeks back.
You have to connect those dots immediately. It's a huge clue.
And finally, psoriatic arthritis, PSA. The link is right there in the name. But what's the clinical trap we have to avoid here?
The trap is assuming the skin rash must come before the joint pain. While most patients do have the skin findings first, a small but really important subset of patients will present with joint symptoms before any rash appears.
So the joint pain can be the first sign.
It can be the herald, not just the follow-up. Absolutely.
This is a deep dive into some serious pathology. And to keep ourselves anchored, let's take a quick pause. We have been talking about a chapter from the free and peer-reviewed textbook, Orthopedia, at www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Penny, and Vayette. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
Now let's contextualize these three diseases with a quick demographic snapshot. The epidemiology offers some excellent differentiators.
Let's start with AS. That's the one most defined by genetics, isn't it?
Absolutely. AS is highly skewed. Males are affected 3 to 4 times more often than females. Onset is early adulthood. And the real genetic fingerprint is HLA-B27. About 90% of AS patients test positive for it.
And reactive arthritis follows a similar, though maybe slightly softer, pattern.
Right. Mostly male early adulthood onset, and about 80% are HLA-B27 positive.
But PSA, psoriatic arthritis, that one completely breaks the mold.
It does. It shows an equal distribution between males and females, which is a major difference.
Right.
And the age of onset is later, typically around 40. So if you have a female patient in her 40s presenting with these symptoms, PSA moves way up on your differential list.
Okay, here's where it gets really, really interesting for clinical practice. The presentation of AS. Let's picture that prototypical young male patient in his 20s. He has this insidious lower back pain and stiffness. How do you distinguish this inflammatory pain from simple mechanical pain, like from osteoarthritis?
This is maybe the single most important clinical distinction in the entire chapter. Mechanical pain, like OA, is usually better with rest and worse with activity. For AS, the pattern is the exact opposite.
The exact opposite.
Yes, the pain is worse in the morning. Patients wake up stiff, sore, and it dramatically improves with activity. They feel better once they're up and moving. If a patient tells you their pain gets better the more they exercise,
Yeah.
that's a powerful, powerful signal for inflammatory spondylitis.
That is gold in the clinic. So beyond what they tell you, how do we objectively measure this stiffness?
We use the Schober test. It's the gold standard for evaluating lumbar stiffness right at the bedside. The process is precise. You mark a 15-centimeter span on the patient's back, 5 centimeters below the line of the iliac crests, and 10 centimeters above it.
Okay, so you have your two marks 15 centimeters apart.
Correct. Then the patient bends forward as far as they can, keeping their knees straight, and you measure the distance between those two marks again.
And what defines a positive stiff result? What are you looking for?
If that distance does not increase by at least 5 centimeters, so the new measurement is 20 centimeters or less, lumbar stiffness is diagnosed. It's a quick way to quantify that loss of motion.
And beyond the spine, AS patients often have problems where tendons and ligaments attach to bone, enthesopathies.
Yes, and there are classic sites, the Achilles tendon, the patellar tendon, and the plantar fascia. Patients will complain of heel pain or knee pain that seems totally disconnected from their back, but it's all part of the same process.
And as AS progresses, what are the two big devastating physical deformities we worry about?
First is a severe hunching, what we call a thoracolumbar kyphotic deformity. That happens in over 30% of cases. Second, because the spine is fused, the rib cage can't move properly, so you get limited chest wall expansion, which can actually cause significant shortness of breath.
Now, let's contrast that heavy spinal presentation with reactor arthritis. When a patient shows up, we're looking for that classic triad of symptoms.
Right. That famous triad is the key: conjunctivitis, urethritis, and arthritis. And remember, the arthritis, the joint pain and stiffness, it often shows up last in that sequence, sometimes weeks after the eye or urinary symptoms.
So if you get those three together with a history of a recent infection, you've pretty much locked it in.
You have your diagnosis locked in.
Exactly. When it comes to confirming these diagnoses, we always start with imaging. What are we looking for on plain film X-rays?
You start with full-length AP and lateral plain radiographs of the spine and pelvis. The very first features you're looking for are sacroiliac erosions and joint space changes, right where the spine meets the pelvis.
But if you suspect it early, and the plain film is negative, you have to go deeper.
Absolutely. MRI is the superior modality for early detection. It can show active inflammation, you know, fluid and edema around the sacroiliac joints much, much earlier than plain film.
Okay, shifting to management. What's the standard first approach for a new patient?
First line is managing inflammation and pain with traditional NSAIDs or COPOS2 inhibitors. And that has to be coupled with aggressive physical therapy. PT is non-negotiable.
But there's a vital safety caution with NSAIDs, especially in this population.
Yes. If you suspect the patient's condition is linked to inflammatory bowel disease, you have to use NSAIDs with extreme caution. They can actually exacerbate the underlying intestinal inflammation and cause a flare.
And if that first-line therapy doesn't work?
Then we move into more specialized drugs. Biological response modifiers like TNF-alpha inhibitors or disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, DMARDs, things like methotrexate or sulfasalazine.
In terms of prognosis, is this group of diseases always chronic and progressive?
Mostly, yes. A and psoriatic arthritis are chronic and insidious. Reactive arthritis, though, is the great exception. Most of those cases are self-limited or they relapse and remit. They get better. But even in that group, about 15% will unfortunately develop chronic arthritis.
Okay, let's pivot to what might be the most critical patient safety alert in this whole deep dive. For patients with an established fused spine from spondyloarthropathy, what happens when they experience trauma?
This is a devastating scenario. Because of the ankylosis, the spine acts like a rigid, brittle column of bone. It has minimal compliance. So a fall that might cause a bruise in a healthy person can cause a high-risk, unstable fracture in these patients. They're extremely susceptible to catastrophic injury.
Even from low-energy trauma?
Even from very low-energy trauma.
So that high index of suspicion is just mandatory. An AS patient comes in after a minor fender bender. What's the immediate action?
Acute neck or back pain requires immediate, rigid immobilization in their pre-injury alignment. You have to treat every single complaint as an unstable fracture until you prove otherwise. That means getting CT or MRI scans immediately.
And if that imaging shows instability or hemorrhage?
At that point, surgical intervention is required promptly. Usually that means decompression to relieve pressure and then a rigid spinal fusion to stabilize the fracture. This is not a situation for delay.
That is an essential warning. Okay, let's finish by tackling a common differential diagnosis that can trick people. Diffuse idiopathic skeletal hyperostosis, or DISH. How do we tell it apart from ES?
There are three non-negotiable distinctions. First is the location of the bone growth. In AS, the syndesmophytes cause fusion within the joint space. In DISH, the bony growths are outside the annulus fibrosus, running alongside the spine.
So inside versus outside the joint, what's the second big one?
Sacroiliac joint involvement. Remember, the SI joint is ground zero for ankylosing spondylitis. DISH has zero involvement of the sacroiliac joint. If the SI joints are clear, it's very unlikely to be AS.
And finally, the age of the patient.
A dead giveaway. AS and reactive arthritis are diseases of young adulthood. DISH is almost exclusively a disease of older men. It's rarely seen in anyone under 50.
We have really managed to pull out the essential knowledge here. Let's finish with the five key concepts you absolutely need to walk away with.
Let's do it.
Number one, ankylosing spondylitis, the prototype. Inflammatory disease of the spine, ascending fusion, HLA-B27.
Number two, reactive arthritis, triggered by an infection, and you're looking for that classic triad, conjunctivitis, urethritis, and arthritis.
Number three, syndesmophytes and bamboo spine. Those are the bony bridges that cause fusion, giving you that unmistakable look on an x-ray.
Number four, the Schober test. Remember the technique.
Yeah.
Mark that 15-centimeter span, and you need an increase of at least 5 centimeters to rule out stiffness.
And number five, diffuse idiopathic skeletal hyperostosis, DIH. The mimicker, differentiated by its lack of SI involvement and its presentation in older patients.
Master those five and you've mastered the chapter.
We have just discussed a chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine, Orthopedia. Orthopedia by Bernstein, Pinion of Ayed. It is available at www.orthopedia.com at no charge. And again, before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book. You'll be glad you did.